Today, GDP, fact or fiction? Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with the distinctive of the Australian flavour and just a touch of philosophy on the side. And there's a bookworm over there. Hi there.
Oh, hi, Martin. Sorry, I was just reading my fictional book on GDP. Methods for Quantitative Macro Comparative Research, a classic that I'm sure everyone will want to rush out and buy.
Oh, look, it's definitely the right thickness to be able to put under my tripod to keep it level.
great.
Well, thanks for joining us again, Salvatore. And it's an interesting subject I think we're going to touch on today because, of course, with the current coronavirus outbreak and all of the predictions about where GDP is going and where it's not, you know, GDP is being thrown around as though it's some magic formula.
Well, the question people often have is, what's the difference between GDP and the economy? Because GDP, of course, is just one way of measuring the economy, and it's not the only way. Yeah. I guess we should remind everyone, if we're going to go back to basics, we should remind everyone what GDP is, a gross domestic product, which is a measurement concept of how much is produced in an output sense. So that is how much is being produced within the borders of a country. The odd thing is we call it GDP, but we don't usually measure it that way. We usually measure it using an expenditure-based approach, which is actually a gross domestic expenditure, which we can then eventually convert into GDP. But it's a measurement hassle because, of course, whenever I give money to someone at my local farmer's market, there's not someone looking over my shoulder to see that the money went. So it becomes a very difficult measurement issue to try to get at just how much is being produced or consumed in a country. But that's the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal of GDP is, what's the size of the money economy? And I stress the money economy. GDP by design does not include housework, does not include unpaid labor, does not include volunteering, does not include many things that make life worth living.
Yeah, and you know, the sorts of activity that it can include, things like gun running and, you know, prostitution, you know, anything that creates momentum.
It is, and actually that's one of the big controversies, is what's in GDP and what's out.
Yeah.
Of course, prostitution, even in places where it's illegal, I mean, in New South Wales, prostitution is legal. Of course, it's in GDP. But even, say, the sale of illicit drugs is theoretically, not always measured, but theoretically part of GDP, while the provision of spiritual counseling for free by a retired minister is not GDP. That minister goes into business and starts selling spiritual advice for 5 cents, it's in GDP. And so we have to remember that GDP is not, directly speaking, a measure of welfare. It's not a measure of how well are people doing. It's a measure of how much economic activity there is. And that's why the drug market's in, right? Because if someone is spending money on drugs, that's part of expenditure. Whether it's a well-made expenditure or whether it's something that is useful is a whole nother issue. When we get to welfare, the kind of measures people are trying to come up with for welfare have much more to do with, you know, how well are people living, which is not the same as how much money is going around in the economy this year.
Mm. And there's a bit of history to GDP, right? So it really, I think, came to the fore after the Second World War, when there was a lot of focus on reconstruction and growth and development. And it has really become, I think, the key measure that, you know, almost all economists quote. And of course, the IMF and the World Economic Forum keep talking about GDP movements, and in fact, within countries too. But, you know, people need to understand it's quite myopic, as we've discussed. And probably there's something else that bugs me a bit, and that is more activity necessarily really a good thing or not?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, if we go back to the history, GDP as a concept was developed by the economist Simon Kuznets, who was active in America. He was an immigrant from Eastern Europe. People argue over which country, so I'm not going to give a credit for which country gets him. The borders have changed so many times. But he worked primarily in the United States. In the 1920s, he developed the concept of the system of national accounts. The idea is that we could do accounting, not just for a firm, but we could do an accounting exercise for an entire country. And so the GDP or GNP or whichever similar concept you use is effectively an income statement for a country. It's how much income is going around, produced and consumed. You can look at it either way, inside the borders of a country, or if you use GNP as a concept, gross national product, how much is produced by the nationals of a country. And the major difference between GDP and GNP is on the treatment of production by national companies abroad. So the profits of, say, Australian companies in China are part of Australia's GNP, but part of China's GDP. So that's usually a minor residual, though for some countries it can be a big difference, especially if they're major financial centers. Kuznets developed it in the U.S. for use by the National Bureau of Economic Research. He was an NBER economist. In the 1930s, it was used for planning in the United States. So one reason planning in the United States, economic planning for World War II, and especially during World War II, was much more effective than in Germany or in the Soviet Union, was that they had these tools available. And of course, you know, planned economy has a bad name these days, but the fact is the whole reason we have GDP is for the planned economy. It became the indispensable tool for war planning in the US and by extension the UK and the Allied countries. After World War II, it was rolled out to the rest of the world, and that's why we call the system of national accounts the United Nations System of National Accounts, the SNA, which is nominally organized through the United Nations system. Of course, the U.S. is extremely influential in that process of defining national accounts. So after World War II, all the countries in the United Nations, which eventually became all the countries of the world, organized their data collection efforts around this system of national accounts. There used to be a separate system of accounts for use in the Soviet Union and other communist countries. That, of course, was all abandoned in the 1990s, and they moved on to the system of national accounts as well. But this has always been a business management tool, not meant to be a welfare indicator. But inevitably, people said, well, we take all of GDP, divided by the number of people, and you have GDP per capita. And often people will simply call that GDP. It really is GDP per person, GDP per capita. And it's used as a welfare measure because it's broadly correlated with what's good for people. I mean, the average American is much richer than the average European, who is much richer than the average Indian or average African. And all of that's reflected in GDP per capita statistics. Does the average American live better than the average European? That's another issue. I mean, one of the strange facts that I like to confront people with, if I asked you which is richer, Japan or Alabama and Mississippi in the Deep South in the United States? Now, of course, Japan appears much richer. I mean, if you've ever been a tourist in Japan, it's super modern, got the Shinkansen, it's like a fantastic place to visit. But in fact, in GDP per capita terms, or gross state product for Mississippi and Alabama, GDP in Alabama and Mississippi is actually higher on a per capita basis than in Japan, quite a bit higher. Well, that's hard to see, but if you start looking at people's consumption choices, well, a typical middle-class family in Alabama or Mississippi can afford a 4 or 5 bedroom home, might have 2 enormous pickup trucks, things that are unimaginable to an average Japanese person who may have a Shinkansen and shiny, you know, robot caregivers, but who lives in a tiny apartment and does not own, you know, his own car. So it's a matter of consumption choices that make Japan appear richer and more high tech. But, you know, there's a lot of high technology in a Ford F-150 pickup truck, and you'll see a lot more of those in Mississippi than you'll see in Tokyo.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's the point, isn't it, that you can start making comparisons that aren't necessarily very valid. And I guess the other point in Australia, with the population increases that we've had, partly through right. migration, in fact, the GDP per capita has gone negative a couple of times, whilst the total top-line GDP number is still going up.
Yeah, oh, I take credit for calling Australia the world's first immigration economy in an article in 2018 in Foreign Policy magazine, and for coining the term per capita recession as it applies to Australia. I later found out that Australia's own Leith Van Onslen had used the term per capita recession in respect to New Zealand a few months before I used it for Australia. But applying it to Australia and outside of the macro business blog, I can claim primacy. Leith gets credit. He's the one who actually coined the term. But Australia and New Zealand are the only countries in the world that have been able to grow themselves out of recessions with population growth. If you adjust for population, the GDP per capita terms, Australia had all the same recessions that were experienced in the US over the past 30 years. There was a recession in Australia in 2001. There was another recession during the global financial crisis. And of course, there's a recession now. But if, with Australia, the per capita, the denominator of that, ratio has just been rising so fast. When viewed on a per capita basis, Australia has been able to sail right through these recessions because its population growth has been so enormous that it has floated the entire economy. That's kind of unique in the world. Now, that's probably ended as a result of the coronavirus pandemic and the end of immigration, but that's one of the reasons why Australia will experience a particularly deep recession compared to its prior experiences during the coronavirus recession.
Yeah, because obviously migration and inward migration in particular is pretty much at zero at the moment and probably right. going to stay that way for some time. And it was interesting that one of the feds in the US last year published a paper that said it's impossible for Australia to go backwards whilst migration is actually so strong as it is for the reasons we've talked about. But now, of course, all that's changed. So the COVID environment really is throwing a very big spotlight on the nature of our local economy and what's driving it. And that's one of the reasons why I have the view that the economy is going to be in some strife for some time.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you know, you're much more the expert on the Australian economy. Mm. Well, I think we all agree that GDP and GDP per capita in Australia are going to decline wrenchingly in the next couple of quarters. Yep. But what does that mean for quality of life in Australia? Does that mean that Australia will suffer the kinds of suffering that were experienced in America during the Great Depression? Are we going to see the same hit to welfare as to GDP?
Well, I think the two questions or the two answers to that question is what's going to happen to unemployment, right? We know unemployment is right. going to rise. The JobKeeper, JobSeeker, that will fade away at some point. And the real unemployment rate will be a lot higher than the official one that's being quoted at the moment. But underemployment right. is, for me, the critical point. And underemployment is already pretty bad. There are many people who are actually not getting the hours that they want. And so the total jobs worked hours is dropping. That's going to be sufficiently a problem, in my view, to really impact the income of a good number of households. And that then flows on because those incomes will not have the discretionary, those households will not have the discretionary income to spend. And that means that the total flow into the economy will also be down. Remember that about half of consumption in Australia is consumer consumption spending. That's where the half of the GDP comes from. The other half comes from the trade balances. So if consumers continue to not spend much, and you could argue, by the way, that the JobKeeper, JobSeeker has allowed people to spend more than they might otherwise in some cases already. Right. I'm expecting that to fade. So if that is true, then the knockover effect of that towards the small and medium enterprise sector is going to be huge, because a lot of the SMEs are servicing, households and small businesses on their own right. So that starts to then unwind. That means they might well buy less in terms of, discretionary items, but perhaps they will not go and buy that new house or move. So potentially that could put a weight on the construction sector, which is already struggling at the moment. And that's 1 million people in Australia at the moment. So you can see how some of these things are cascading. And then, of course, internationally, if the international trade continues to perhaps weaken, the results came out today. Coal was down a bit, both in terms of volume and price, which is, one of the things that's been really supporting the economy for some time. So the international trade links could mean that could actually weaken too. So I'm struggling at the moment to see where the growth is going to come from. Tourism, continues to be weak because of international tourists not coming. Students, as we discussed last time, not coming back. So I'm trying to work out where the growth engine elements are other than the government throwing more money into the economy. And if you look at it at the moment, they've done a lot of that.
So, but might Australia's neo-socialism, and I'm not endorsing it, this is a question I'm asking you, is it possible that the new socialism of JobKeeper or JobSeeker, is that going to increase welfare in Australia? I mean, anecdotally, I've heard a lot of people talking about how they love on JobKeeper, even if it means they've taken a pay cut, they don't have to work, and they think that's fantastic, and they're having lunches out. Now, I know there's a lot of people are in serious trouble, losing their homes, things like that, but is it possible that for a majority of people, especially for people in two-income households, where one person has lost their income and the other's on JobKeeper, where that one person still has the income, the other one's on JobKeeper, is it possible they're actually experiencing better welfare? Is it possible that a more socialistic Australia would be a higher welfare and broadly speaking, a happier Australia than one where everyone has to go to work?
Well, yeah, that's very interesting. Certainly, it looks that way, because I'm seeing the same in my surveys, that those people who actually have a different formulation now, thanks to JobKeeper, JobSeeker, have a bit more time to do the things. They're not traveling so far and fast to work and back. They're working more at home. They're doing a bit more part-time work. And this comes back to the fundamental question of how you measure success, happiness, or whatever you want to measure, right? It could well be that you end up with a society that actually is more comfortable in its own skin, as it were, despite the fact that it might not be actually creating quite so much GDP. You take the argument a bit further, well, universal basic income is then the answer, because basically that gives people the choice of whether they want to work or whether they don't want to work. And I did an interview quite recently with Guy Standing, European academic, who basically argues very strongly that, in fact, the net benefit to most people from UBI is actually positive in terms of outcome and welfare, even if economically it doesn't necessarily take you in the same place.
Right. And I actually disagree with that. I mean, it's funny. I'm the only sociologist I know who's opposed to universal basic income. Yeah. It's because of the speculation about what the long-term effect is. You know, we have a lot of circumstantial evidence that it's hard to use such an old-fashioned term, but the dignity of work is very important for people's psychological well-being.
That's very Victorian.
It is, but it doesn't mean it's not true.
No.
And we have a lot of evidence that it is true, and we have a lot of sociology going all the way back to Emile Durkheim 100 years ago, suggesting that it was important for society that people feel they're doing something, or for that matter, going back to Karl Marx and Alienation. So the idea that it's very important that people feel like they're contributing, feel like they're doing something. And while it may sound great for 3 months to be on a universal basic income, in the end, people will be tempted. You know, that person who always wanted to be an artist is going to just push to make that attempt to be an artist, who is never going to succeed, and who will bounce along on universal basic income instead of being forced to confront the hard reality that she or he has to go towards another profession. And I see a kind of microcosm of that in academia, where we used to have an enormous casual workforce. Now with the funding cuts, we're losing our casual workforce. We're decasualizing. They won't be there anymore. But this casualized workforce, I mean, I used to know and still do know some academics who got a PhD and spent 20, 30 years living on essentially minimum wage, getting a few tutorials every semester, doing tutorials at two or three universities, being stuck in that because they had a PhD, because they could just get by with it. They wouldn't make the hard decision to enter another profession. Instead, they would be this casualized, very unhappy, very exploited underclass in the academic world. And I would always advise people in this situation, look, you're never going to get a permanent professorship at this point after 10 years as a casual. Time to move on. And that's something that, because people could get just enough to get by on, they stayed trapped in that world. Now, I've been unemployed. I may be unemployed again soon. And I'm not saying I want to be unemployed. It's a very traumatic experience to be unemployed. Mm. But it may ultimately be better for you to be forced into the labor market than to have the opportunity to live a carefree life, but a very low productivity, low engagement with society life. I mean, I know there's always someone who will use that universal basic income to live life as a volunteer helping save the world. But for every one of those, there are 20 people on a universal basic income who are playing video games in their parents' basement. And I just don't think that's necessarily what's best for them.
Well, I'm not necessarily an advocate of UBI either. It's a very interesting and quite timely conversation, because you could argue that JobKeeper, JobSeeker is almost sort of taking us towards that direction. And you mentioned, earlier on the sort of socialism that's sort of flowing through. The really interesting question for me, though, is, where does that lead us? Does it lead us to a cul-de-sac or somewhere else? Because I would also argue that the neoliberalist sort of view that really is driving things at the moment is separating the winners from the losers, the haves and the have-nots in society, probably more than ever before. And at least if there's an alternative, maybe that stops that diversity. There's no one right answer, I guess.
Well, so inequality is a tough nut. So we use the standard poverty measure used around the world outside the United States for most of the rest of the world is a poverty measure that is essentially an inequality measure. It's the percentage of population living on either less than half the median income or on less than 60% of the median income. Now, if you simply ask, what percentage live at less than half the median income, you might as well ask, what's the standard deviation of incomes? They're going to give you the same answer. They're correlated 0.9 or higher. They're essentially the same indicator. And so we have this problem that if we want to measure what is a decent life, what kind of system produces a decent life for the most people? Well, there are two ways of getting a decent life for everyone. One is to say we want to, rising tide lifts all ships. We want everyone to do better. Another approach is to say, we want to reduce inequality to pull people out of poverty. But of course, you're not really pulling people out of poverty. You're only by definition pulling people out of poverty, because by definition, less inequality means less poverty. Now, in the US, they use an absolute poverty measure. That is, there's simply a line that was denominated in 1968, updated for inflation since then, and we measure the percentage of people who fall below that line. So if there were a rising tide, it would lift all ships. And since that line was set in 1968, you'd expect that by today the U.S. would have no more poverty. In effect, the U.S. has a lot of poverty, and the reason is that at the same time that the rising tide has been rising in the U.S., inequality has been expanding so dramatically that it's still left a group of people down below that poverty line. In fact, about the same number of people in percentage terms as were there in 1968. So when we think about welfare, if we want to get past GDP and to think about happiness, welfare, well-being in society, well, we have to think about incomes. We have to think about inequality. We also have to think about consumption, because a big difference between countries is the percentage of income that actually goes to consumption, or the percentage of income that is personal income as opposed to other forms of income. I mean, in some societies, income is skewed towards government and corporations. That is, personal income is relatively lower. And so there's also less well-being. I mean, if all the money is going to Facebook and Googles of the world and none of it is coming into your pocket, does it really matter to you that there's more GDP if you're not getting a slice of it? So all of these three variables, really, GDP, the rising tide, inequality, and even the distribution of income by category across the economy, all of these affect how well people are able to live. And unfortunately, we have great measures for GDP. We have okay measures for the distribution of income functionally. We have terrible measures for inequality. And as a result, we can't easily know how people are doing without doing a lot of very detailed survey work. You can't just get the quarterly numbers that tell you how well people are doing. We can get the quarterly numbers for GDP, and that's why we tend to use them much, much more than we should, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I sometimes think it's quite utilitarian insofar that you can at least get those numbers. But, the perspective I have is this, that concept of the fact that there are other things that we should be thinking about when we make our decisions rather than just the GDP lens is quite important. And I don't think government's doing a very good job. They tend to focus on GDP. And in fact, if you talk to most of the senior politicians and the senior mandarins down in Canberra, they're all GDP fixated, right? I think there's got to be another canvas. But the other lens I want to bring as we close our conversation today is we've only got one planet, right? And the population is growing and we're using more and more of the resources of the planet. So there's got to be a point when GDP actually takes us into the the future where we effectively have used the resources beyond what we can use and should be using. And that takes us into the conversation about climate change and adapting to a different type of future. So in a way, I blame GDP and the fixation on GDP as one of the reasons why we've ended up going down that route.
Well, a lot of people do, and we have efforts to create environmentally adjusted GDPs or resource-adjusted GDPs to adjust for the amount of the world's endowment that has been used up, so to speak. But honestly, I'm not a big fan of those approaches. I think that I'm a neo-Victorian, as you pointed out. And look, as economies become more sophisticated, they're using less and less stuff. And I expect that trend to continue. Now, of course, you can see that clearly in the high technology world and us buying virtual apps and us consuming streamed content, even us here on YouTube. I mean, we're using electricity in the server farms, but that's about it. But you can also see it in the offline world. So I always give the example to people of coffee consumption. If you just want a cup of coffee, but you can brew it at home for virtually nothing, you can go to 7-Eleven and spend $1 for a cup of coffee, or you can go to your favorite cafe and spend upwards of $5 for a cup of coffee. And what you're getting in that is the same burden on the planet. It's the same burden on the planet whether you have the cup of coffee at 7-Eleven or at your favorite cafe. But one of those is producing five times as much GDP as the other. So even a cup of coffee is primarily, for most people in my neighborhood of Sydney and places like Darlinghurst, for most of us, a cup of coffee is primarily a service. Now, it's not measured that way in the statistics. It comes across as a good. But when you're buying a $5 cup of coffee, most of it is the experience that you enjoy of having the coffee. It's not the physical beans. And that's what we're seeing as economies grow and develop. We're seeing this move away from consumption of stuff towards consumption of experiences, consumption of services. And if anything, I think we should accelerate that. So rather than looking to scale back GDP or to de-target GDP, which I think is just not practical. I mean, the old management adage is what gets measured gets done. And GDP is going to be measured. As long as it's measured, it's going to get done. But what we can do is have government policy that tries to shift our focus away from the consumption of things and towards the consumption of services. And that can be done through variable taxation rates. So GST could be different on different categories of goods and services. You could eliminate GDP for services entirely. We could have differences of regulation that make it lighter touch regulation on the provision of services than we currently have. I mean, right now in Australia, services are extraordinarily regulated in general, whereas goods are very lightly regulated. Well, that tends to tilt the playing field towards consuming stuff. If we tended to make stuff more expensive and difficult to consume, and services and experiences less difficult to experience and consume, we would see a shift in that direction. And it's that sort of subtle change I'd like to see instead of a wholesale abandonment of what has proved to be a very useful concept.
No, that's very interesting. I hadn't sort of considered it like that. And I guess what that says is that if you actually do make some of those adjustments in the way that you actually, weight some of the measurement, then you could actually get different behaviours and different outcomes. And that could actually lead to higher levels of welfare without necessarily just creating a bigger GDP number.
Well, or we could still create the bigger GDP number, just do it in a way that is less impactful on the physical environment.
No. Yeah, interesting. Well, I knew this was going to be an interesting conversation, and I think you and I probably have come away with a slightly different opinion. I still think that GDP is a little bit of a mistaken measure, and it's actually leading us up a bit of a blind alley. I think you're much more optimistic. So let's hope you're right and I'm wrong.
I always hope that.
Great to talk to you, and I'm sure we'll pick up the conversation again quite soon.
Thanks, Martin.
Cheers.